In its heyday, respected around the world for its measured and objective reporting, its courage and its openness to explore new fronts and challenge existing conventions, the BBC is not the same today. It has become a mouthpiece of the establishment, and in so doing, it has sold out the people who pay for it. Why is it that when private companies do bad shit, they claim it is in an effort to satisfy their shareholders? But when the BBC or even government disregard the interests of their shareholders, the electorate and the license-paying public, then it's a different matter. No, it is not. You are tricking the public, you are lying, you are obfuscating, you are working contrary to the interests of the people. In the 1950s, Edward R. Murrow took on the establishment of the McCarthy years, when the senator from the state of Wisconsin divided society in the US in his witch hunt for anybody he deemed not patriotic enough by his measure as being a communist. Or the spotlight team from the Boston Globe that took down the decades-old child sexual abuse ring covered up within the Boston Archdiocese. There are sections within the BBC framework that do great work. I'm not going to draw attention to any of them here. People can make up their own minds if they use the BBC. However, I have stopped using the BBC for any political content because there is simply zero political objectivity from my perspective on the site on the issues of the day that matter. It is extremely frustrating reading a BBC article on any political event that even remotely touches British or NATO interests. It is absurd how predictably tame the BBC is in offering a critique of the establishment. What is the point of the BBC if it no longer has the respect of the people who need it? It simply does not contain enough objective material for the exercise to be worthwhile. There is not enough journalistic and analytical content free of propagandized material to justify using the BBC over any other media outlet, so I don't bother. Unless, of course, the exercise is to research the depth of propaganda in mainstream media, in which case the BBC politics pages are a fantastic source of information. As always, I am extremely grateful to my friend, the political analyst Esheru, for his time, his knowledge, and his insight. I wish you well, brother, in the new year, as I do all of the people who are fighting for what they believe to be a positive ideal, a progressive form of politics in the coming year. I wish you success, and I wish you patience for what is to come. Tuna Mike, clocking out. Enjoy.
Jepek kuduelo mabiro etu under mic. Dung parodit kod jok mawo yetu under mic. Seche tim sudbuta wawinji etu under mic. Wola wachokre wabed ping bi wawinje erochako the moment ndi podcast makende.
I'm very happy to say that I'm joined again by my good friend and political activist, Esheru. Esheru, welcome back.
Good morning, and thank you very much for inviting me once again, Zach. I hope you've had a wonderful Christmas.
Yep, it's been relaxing. We've had a couple of unexpected guests who we have since asked politely to leave. Basically mice. We had some mice come and visit us, but we removed them alive and well. We didn't trap them with those murderous traps. We caught them in a humane manner, and they're hopefully enjoying themselves outside in the sunshine. I couldn't think of a better way to basically politically, as it were, end the year than having a chat with you and getting some more of your insight. And specifically, a few days ago, you sent me a link from a site called Dropsite News, which was an extremely interesting, very long, very well presented, well argued document. Do you want to talk a bit about that for us?
Absolutely. Now, the journalist, we can call him Owen Jones, he does a lot of work with The Guardian. He obviously, like everybody, has witnessed what's been happening in Gaza over the last 14 months or so. And everybody's been studying the news now. He is one that's been consistently, along with Matt Kennard and several other people, consistently calling out the biases from the mainstream or public broadcaster in Britain here, the BBC. And he has spent a lot of time, very in-depth article, as you said, and he mentions this in the opening text of the article itself, that you may need to read this in a couple of sittings because of the sheer length of it. So when I read that, I went and got myself a cup of coffee. just throwing that in. But yeah, so basically what he's done, along with there's another, this wasn't with this organization, of course, but various other organizations have done a very similar thing, where they've studied the level of bias reporting in favor of Israel by the BBC. And well, you read the article yourself. It's very, very inconsistent with what we're witnessing, what Al Jazeera is reporting, what independent journalists like Jonathan Cook are reporting, or Peter Oborn. It's almost that the BBC is reporting in an alternate universe.
Yeah, I mean, and also it points out the fact that the BBC doesn't at least publicly declare or make it obvious that, you know, the government of Israel does not allow journalists into the area to investigate events for themselves, that they are basing their news articles 100% on whatever they have been told by the Israeli information ministry. And in some ways, or in some cases, they're perhaps just simply copy and pasting the content there. But they also referred to an individual who kind of lingers in the background of the Middle East desk, who essentially, that person, and apparently this has been going on for a few years now, but that person has to greenlight all of the articles that are written about the genocide in Gaza.
Let's call it what it is. It's propaganda. Okay. Yeah. And if people are unhappy with that word because it conjures up images of, I don't know, Joseph Goebbels, let's call it perception management. Okay. What they're actually doing is, we know that war crimes are being committed. This is a fact. I'm not saying that. The UN have stated this, the ICJ, Albanese has stated this. Okay. This isn't anything new. So, just letting people know that I'm not putting words into your mouths or your minds. War crimes are being committed, but they're being covered up, okay? And let's remember that when the outbreak of the war, one of the first things, it did take some time, but the Knesset, which is the Israeli parliament, was able to ban Al Jazeera from reporting inside Gaza. Now, remember this, they keep telling us that Gaza was... Gaza wasn't occupied. If Gaza wasn't occupied, why did Gaza have so many checkpoints on it? Why is it journalists weren't allowed to go in freely and report, as they would be able to fly to any country freely and report as long as they announced their visit? Why is it we still now are not seeing reports from inside Gaza if Gaza is not occupied? Okay, these are just something simple people need to look at. The Israeli government knows that it's committed war crimes and it's doing its best to cover it up. And we will only, you know, as time goes on, whether they allow people in or not, I don't know, but we will only be able to ever hear whispers on the vine as opposed to actual evidence, because I believe that they will continue to cover up the crimes that they've committed, and they will be supported by Western governments. The hypocrisy of which, in my opinion, is astounding, because if we make a comparison to, let's say, what's happening between Russia and Ukraine, for example, do you honestly believe that Russia would be able to... Did you read that they that they got rid of the last hospital in Gaza a couple of days?
I did.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, could you imagine if Russia had managed to, let's just say, get rid of all civilian infrastructure just within the Kiev area of Ukraine? Could you imagine the news reporting around that? It would be nonstop. We wouldn't stop hearing about it. But we're constantly told that Israel does have the right to defend itself, and you know, the hostages need to be released. I mean, I don't even hear people talking about hostages anymore. that was on the tip of their tongues once upon a time. Now it's all violence.
Yeah, I mean, there is also this issue that it's a war crime to target civilian infrastructure. Now, it seems as though the Israeli government has tried to get around that by saying, yeah, but Hamas has built tunnels in all of these hospitals and so on. So, I mean, whether or not that actually is any kind of recognized justification in law, in any domestic law, in any international law, I don't know. I'm not a legal specialist. But for me, it smells a bit weird because to now, or to this date, we still haven't seen any definitive proof of these tunnels. I'm sure these tunnels probably exist. Let's face it, they existed in Vietnam as well. And at the end of the day, if you are an occupied land, it is actually perhaps to be expected that some kind of resistance organization should establish itself. So that's also not exactly a complete surprise to us.
Fully agree with you. I do believe they have a small network of tunnels, but not to the extent that they claim that they have them. If you remember, one of the very, very first, it was probably the only time I believe that they allowed Western journalists in to report from a hospital. Do you remember? And how heavily organized that was. And they didn't allow them free movement within the hospital, for example. I think I saw a CNN report recently where a reporter was able to move around a prison in Syria very freely, without any restrictions. But when of course we look back to what happened in Gaza, they were telling reporters that, well, don't go down there, don't look down there, and the flimsiest of evidence to suggest that there was a huge resistance network within the hospital. And let's remember, I believe the IDF headquarters, the IDF's headquarters are in a very built-up area of Tel Aviv, if memory serves me correctly. Again, this isn't secret. So when they tell you Hamas likes to hide in civilian areas, well, the IDF has its has its office block in front of, you know, a residential block. So aren't they doing exactly the same thing that they say Hamas are doing?
Well, I mean, I don't know exactly what the rules are with military infrastructure. I mean, there aren't any army bases in the center of London, but there are army bases in areas which are not too far from civilian areas. There's RAF Northolt, Northwood. These are places which are just a few hundred meters away from homes. GCHQ is in the middle of town, I think, where MI5 and MI6 operate from. I mean, I don't know.
And you've got army barracks in West London also.
So, sure. Yeah. So, these, they've also got to be quite easy to get to, right? I mean, they employ a lot of people, so you can't put them out into the sticks either. So, I mean, we have to be a bit realistic here when we talk about these kinds of things. And so, therefore, especially if we're talking about a place like Gaza, and if you remember back in 2022, Amnesty International released a report on Israel where it said it declared Israel to be an apartheid state. And yep, a lot of people came out in disagreement of that, with a fake I can't believe it, this is an insult and so on. But that has since, not only since, at the time I read the entire report, and it was extremely clear, they highlighted the exact reasons why, as per the apartheid convention, why,
yep,
the individual structure or in specific places was exactly a case of apartheid.
Yeah.
So, you know, any denial of that is simply ridiculous.
Well, let's remember that Israel is the last colonial outpost of the West. Okay, the West wants to establish a permanent base, a permanent landmass there. Okay, they did it in Australia. They've done it in the four corners of the world. Okay, now this is the center of the world, if you will, for them, and this is exactly what they want to do: establish a base there so they can have control of the region. Because let's remember, this region here is probably the region on the earth that has the most amount of oil, natural crude oil, and the best quality crude oil, and the West want to be able to control that as we move forward into the future. Because when we look at renewable energy sources, there's not enough. Let's look at the structure of oil very briefly. I don't want to go too far after something. But from crude oil itself, you extract God knows how many different products, everything from car bumpers to nail varnish to you name it. You've got so much. And there just isn't a financially viable replacement for crude oil in the world right now today. It is probably the most lucrative natural resource that the world has. And those in power with the money want control of it. And it's the reason, sole reason why they want to control the Middle East. Nothing else. That's it. Despite all the chat, okay, that's the sole reason. That's it.
Yeah. I agree with you. I'm an environmentalist, and this is a topic which, yeah, I think we should come back to. I mean, by the previous two decisions of hosting sites for COP28 and COP29, we know that they were held in petrostates. In the latest one in Baku, Azerbaijan, it's a genocidal petrostate. So it's not as though the principles which exist behind international organizations such as United Nations, which created COP, are particularly consistent in these areas. But we wanted to talk about the BBC, and and we've kind of used the genocide in Gaza as a vehicle to point out the limitations of the BBC. Now, Gaza and what's happening there in itself has been covered by people also on the ground. As you said, there are lots of reports that continue to come out of Gaza, even though the number of independent journalists in Gaza, it has dwindled to such an extent that never before in history have so many journalists been targeted and killed as they have done there. And this has also been highlighted by a number of different organizations. But, you know, to go back to the BBC, I kind of had a thought. We said we wanted to talk about this, and I had a thought. Whenever private companies do something and people ask them, well, why do you do this? They always respond and say, yeah, but we've got shareholders. Now, the BBC has license payers. For me, the license payers kind of act as shareholders. So why the hell is it that when we talk about the perhaps the lack of objectivity of the BBC, there's nobody that says, well, yeah, I mean, you know, shareholders here or license payers here and so on. There's none of that. They say what they want regardless.
This is the thing that bothers me about the structure of the BBC. Now, it's the public that funds the BBC. The latest BBC, when I look at the board, if you look at the board, the I think four of the people that sit on the board, the decision makers, I think there's about nine of them. I think four of them are Tory, ex-Tory donors, and they've been all handpicked by Boris Johnson in order to obviously give them favorable coverage. But at the same time, people will tell you the BBC's independent. It's independent from government, okay? This is the thing. People are fooled into believing what we're told about the BBC being this having this independent board of people. But how can they be independent if they've been once used to donate to the party that was in power? They're representative of foreign governments. I know Robbie Gibb, for example. I think his name's Robbie Gibb. He, the editor-in-chief at the Jewish Chronicle, or the owner of the Jewish Chronicle?
I think he was, yeah. He sold it, but yeah, he was.
Right, okay. Yeah. So of course, he's going to have influence, political influence, and political favor in the way that content is then shown to the people. If we had anything that represented an independent broadcaster, these people's political affiliations wouldn't come across in the programming. We would have an organization that would have been very critical when the government does bad and very supportive when the government does good, and it would never blur the lines. But what we have is an organization that is instructed to report news a certain way to show maybe a small group of people or an individual in a very good light, even though we know that they're not very good, and vice versa. And this is the problem that we have in Britain, generally speaking, in our media. But a national broadcaster, such as the BBC, because of the paying customer, i.e. the license fee payer, they owe it to them to provide better news content. That's it.
Now, there was in the article written by Owen that he established a difference between reporting from the BBC main website, which people in the UK can see, and BBC World. That there were some elements which were expressed in BBC World, which were not expressed necessarily on the main website. And perhaps there's a reason that we can understand for that. But the fact remains, the main BBC website is the one which people visit the most. This is one where perhaps there is the greater burden of responsibility, especially to the license fee payers, because this is the site they see.
Absolutely. This is the issue. I've lost count over the amount of times I've heard The Guardian and the BBC report that they follow the right guidelines and they follow the right channels and they do things from a legal perspective, only to see that they make a series of errors, and these errors are deliberate. I know that they're not accidents. Okay, they allow them to run and then they make the change much later on during the night or whatever when most people are not watching. But you'll have read the truth 3 days before from an independent journalist. But because an independent journalist doesn't have the backing of a larger organization's name, they are less likely to be taken serious by your average person in the street. Okay, if you're skilled at reading the media and you have a good understanding of the media, then you're good at deciphering, you know, what's good and what's bad. Or if you know where to look for your news, you can then corroborate what that journalist is trying to say, the independent, and compare that with the BBC. And unfortunately, the major channels like the BBC, etc., today, they are instructed to report the media in a certain way. Again, it's that word again, perception management. They have to report the world not according to the way what the world is, but the way that the establishment wants us to see the world.
And I'm also glad that you introduced The Guardian, because whenever I talk about something online and I criticize a certain right-wing newspaper from saying this or saying that, people respond to me, say, oh, and you think The Guardian is so, you know, wonderful. And I'm like, no, sorry, I do not in any way argue for The Guardian. I've stopped reading The Guardian. I found the levels of inconsistency within The Guardian to be ridiculous. And I don't find anything remotely trustworthy within The Guardian, even though there are, I'm sure, lots and lots of wonderful, trustworthy reporters. But I don't find enough objective reporting on the issues which for me are important in The Guardian. And so therefore, I had to pull away from that. But just to come back to the issue of investigative journalism. Now, I once listened to a podcast where a woman who used to work as an investigative journalist in the 80s or 90s, she said that she had to leave the BBC because it had simply become, as you say, like a mouthpiece for the establishment, that they were simply not allowed or they were discouraged from reporting on the topics that they felt were important. I have seen, and even in this letter, which Owen Jones refers to, or in his article, there is a letter written by over 100 people within the BBC who complained about the level of control. So it's not as though the BBC is completely tainted from head to toe. There are a lot of people within the organization who want to do things differently, but they're not allowed to do so. And I think we should also draw attention to these people. I thought about when investigative journalism was really a thing, and I don't know how far back we have to go. But what I always remember is Edward R. Murrow, when he took on Senator McCarthy from Wisconsin, if you remember, and his witch hunt, were trying to find communists. That was back in the 50s. Then I'm also reminded of the Spotlight team from the Boston Globe, who took on the Boston Diocese for their child sexual abuse campaign that had been running essentially for decades. This was back in the early 2000s. Now, there have been individual news stories here and there, but absolute breaking news conducted by the BBC itself, which the BBC itself brought out, I can't remember for a long time.
I don't think they report the news anymore. That's something I've said. The media no longer informs. That's what I've said. I can think of two guys called... they used to work for The Guardian. David Cromwell and David Edwards, okay? They run a news site called Media Lens. And what Media Lens does, it looks at the BBC, it looks at The Guardian, it looks at all the major papers within the country. And I'm not talking about the Daily Mail or The Sun. We know that they're trash. But those what's supposed to be credible. And they analyze what's being said. And then they do the background on it and then hold the newspapers and broadcasters accountable. The late John Pilger spoke highly of them. Peter Olborn speaks highly of the work that these guys do. And what you find is that the media won't break news today because if the news to be broken is about Israel, they won't break the news because there has to be a level of perception management around how that news is delivered. Okay. If it's news around Russia, they'll speculate. From the minute the news is broken, there'll be speculation. Even if Russia's name is not mentioned, they will always leave a smaller clue to make people, you know, think that maybe Russia is involved. They always leave a seed of doubt in people's minds. Whereas with Israel, there will always be a level of innocence as far as they can possibly go until it can then... And even if the entire independent space is saying that Israel is at fault, the BBC will stick with Israeli innocence. And then maybe days later, at a point where it's no longer relevant, they'll mention Israel's name. But as long as their poor consumers believe that Israel is innocent, that's the job that they need to do. So they will never, they don't break stories in the same way that they used to, because it is about getting the information out in a certain way to get people to then to be convinced that maybe it's not Israel's fault. And most people today receive their news through apps on phones or the social media, but there are still swathes of the population that go to the TV and receive their news. And these are the people that are being targeted.
Yeah, there is this continuing tendency to believe what is coming out of the BBC, because it still does have this reputation of being an authority on truth, on authority on objectivity.
Correct.
But we clearly know that that's not the case. And it's not just the BBC. It's also the main, as it were, state mouthpieces for, you know, in many different countries. It's the same in Germany as well, unfortunately, from what I have seen. There isn't enough objectivity around the world. And one of the side effects of, or the consequences of this particular policy, is that people leave these areas and they start to look for, should we say, amateur news providers. And the problem with this is, and I myself would say I'm perhaps an amateur, even though I don't provide news, but I give my opinion. The problem for this is, you know, I've studied politics and I think what I'm talking about is correct, but I don't necessarily have any sense of responsibility for trying to present both sides. I don't believe that, for example, the other side in a particular case here, let's say that we're talking about Israel. So, you know, when somebody says to me, yeah, but what happened here? Yeah, what happened there? Yeah, okay, I understand that there have been a lot of travesties committed on every side of this conflict. But at the moment, we are talking about genocide, and you cannot justify genocide with any kind of activity, whatever that may be. And so I jump from that perspective. So I think a lot of people who go to amateur or non-professional news sources, they don't necessarily realize that these people don't have, as you say, the highest levels of integrity with regards to information provision that perhaps somebody else may have had who studied journalism.
Absolutely. What I would tell anybody listening to this that, you know, wants to make the jump to, you know, to study more independent journalists, what I would do is always do a little bit of background on the person itself. I mean, you've got a lot of people that blog out there, but they're not professional journalists. Like, for example, Caitlin Johnston, she is extremely good at what she does, but she's not a professional journalist. But that doesn't mean to say what she says isn't credible. But it's understanding her work from 10 years ago, which will put you in a position today to understand that what she writes makes sense. I know that from following her for the last 10 years. But I would always tell people, you do the background, have a look at what people like Matt Kennard were doing, or Jonathan Cook is one who I absolutely love. Originally from Bristol, I believe that he's married to a Palestinian woman, lives in Nazareth. He has worked for the BBC, The Guardian. He no longer likes the mainstream media and does his own work. Again, look at the credentials of the people, and then you can decide if these people are qualified enough to give you the information that you are looking for. Because I often believe when you look at The Guardian itself or the BBC, for example, they may take people in who have the journalistic degrees, but having a degree doesn't necessarily mean that you are qualified to do the work. Do you understand me?
Absolutely true.
Because Caitlin Johnston, I believe, doesn't have a journalist degree, but she is more than qualified in what she's doing. That's just my opinion.
Definitely. And she does present mainly opinion pieces, so she doesn't herself break the news, but her opinion pieces, her analysis is spot on.
Absolutely. She's better than some of the most professional journalists that you see out there. When I look at people like Camilla Tomany, for example, or even Catherine Viner at The Guardian, I mean, she used to be something. She no longer is, unfortunately, even since she took over The Guardian. But it changed when she took over. And when I look at people like Caitlin Johnston and I make a comparison, she has nothing on Caitlin Johnston, in my opinion.
I was kind of wondering because, I'm going to put a list of things in the introduction, which I've already more or less compiled. But I was wondering why it is that mainstream media has allowed itself to be manipulated in this way. And the one thing I think about is if we go back to the 90s, when we started to see political TV shows really kick in, a lot of the times, a lot of the reasons why on TV shows or in movies, why politicians, activists, or why influential people do things, they present certain arguments, whether it's national interest, whether it's national security, and so on. And for some reason, I get the feeling a lot of these politicians, a lot of these political advisors, these spin doctors, these senior editors, they've been watching a lot of TV series. And they've just basically stolen those bullshit lines from their favorite movies. And they're living their lives by the principles that have been established in Hollywood. And that is ridiculous.
We live in a world where, if you look at just the previous government, well, politics in general over the last 10 years, it's all sound bites and one-liners. They love three-worded slogans, you know, build back better, for example. Let's get it done. You know, they love these little short three-worded slogans, and it's all sound bites. There's no substance to what it is they're saying. I mean, right about now, we've got the whole stop the boats, another three-worded slogan with no substance. Yes, stop the boats. What boats? You know, why are these people fleeing? We heard about all these Syrians that were coming over and people saying that they were economic migrants. And then now we've had a look at what's happening in the Syrian jails and people are like, oh, maybe there were escaping problems. Let's have a look at the context behind what's going on. And then one of the problems with the media, it never provides any context. Things just happened. You know, people are fleeing here to get to Britain. Why? Because they want to take advantage of our very generous welfare state. First of all, Britain has probably the least generous welfare state in all of the countries across the EU. And I'm even talking about including those across Eastern Europe. Okay. Secondly, when you look at the Ipsos polls and the Statista polls, the top reasons as to why people want to come to Britain are often family, work, studies, and then other reasons, always the smallest, which is usually because they want to get away from problems or war or famine or whatever. And that's usually the smallest reason as to why people want to get away. But nobody bothers themselves with the facts these days, unfortunately. And the media is one of them. And it really grates me because I think the media needs to provide more context into the stories because it continues to shape people's perceptions around, you know, half-truths and lies and some lies. And that's a problem. It's something which plagues our society.
Yeah, and it's also quite entertaining. Well, I say entertaining, it's actually very sad. But you do mention that, and I've heard it a lot of, I think everybody's heard it, yeah, economic migrants and so on. One second, don't we live in a capitalist society where everybody's taught, basically from childhood, you're in it for yourself, look after number one, the most important thing is money, you know? So 1 minute, we're allowed to be capitalistic, exploitative, trying to make a buck, but other people can't? Is that what they're saying?
That's basically it. That's basically it. People need, and again, it's about providing that context. If we look at the countries that people are fleeing, if we look at the geographical position, if we look at the resources, if we look at some of these countries, why is it that the countries that people are fleeing are very, 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 have a lot of resources, the potential to be very wealthy, but these people are amongst the poorest people or people in the most turmoil? Why is that? Why are we not looking at that? Why is it whenever we have not stopped hearing about boats and small crossings in this country since, well, probably before I arrived back in 2017, but is what brought about Brexit. But why are we not hearing? Why has nobody in the last 10 years not mentioned the reason why people are fleeing and taking a look at those countries and what's happening in those countries and getting to the bottom of that? Why is nobody doing that? Again, it is about perception. And I think that people, the media is not interested in reporting the news in the way it should be reported, because if it did, then all of a sudden we'd realize that we are to blame here in the West for fueling or giving rise to people having to create the conditions, having people fleeing those places to come to here.
Yep. And the unfortunate consequence of all of this is that organizations such as the BBC, once respected around the world for its reporting,
yep,
no longer hold that position.
No.
I no longer read the BBC or the Guardian News when I want to read something about a political story or political analysis or anything like that. I go to alternative news sites because they strike me as being more genuine and more objective. And that's the reality.
I'll tell you something I read yesterday in Squawk Box. I believe that it might have been Politico or one of these organizations must have reported that Keir Starmer is the most right-wing Labour leader ever. The Guardian posted the same story, but they posted it as the least left-wing was the worst. I'll share it with you after. It's really interesting.
Yeah, please.
And it just goes to show you how they're covering for him instead of just saying how it is. I know this for a fact. When I look at the country, and I've said this prior in the run-up to the election, I didn't vote Starmer. I'm not a fan. I've made no secret of that. But in our country, we don't have any. When you look at all the mainstream parties, none of them are centre-left. They're all centre-right. And you know, you still hear people in the media claim that Labour is a centre-left party. And I'm sat here thinking, stop lying to the people. It isn't. They've done nothing remotely centre-left. There's no one in the cabinet that's centre-left. They've expunged all the left, centre-left people from the party. And those that remain have had to shut up or become independents. So let's say it how it is. So, you know, an opportunity was presented for the Guardian to at least pick up that baton and claim that Starmer was centre-right, but they didn't. The least left-wing government or left-wing leader. It's like, come on, really?
Yeah, and also we should include in the background to that particular assessment is that, unfortunately, in modern times, the left is considered almost like an insult in some spheres of political persuasion. And so therefore, that's actually a compliment from that perspective. However, obviously, we know that anybody who looks at the word left wing or the word progressive or the word woke, unfortunately, in a negative way, these are people who simply have been completely fooled and taken in by the establishment and are just too lazy to do the research.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, this is how it is in our world today. That the way that the news is delivered, it's delivered in such a way that you don't have to think. And I don't mean to make people sound stupid, but there's the structure of the news is they give you the opening. They give you the middle piece, and then they conclude it for you, so you don't have to conclude it. So, yeah, and most people, let's just say if you get an article of five paragraphs and there's 10 lines in each paragraph, people probably only read the first two paragraphs, unless it's a subject that they're really interested in. Most people never get to the end, unfortunately. It's the way it is.
Yeah, this is also why headline writing indeed is so important. It's become a bit of an art. And indeed, a lot of headlines don't even reflect what's written in the articles themselves. So,
that's right. They get to the nuts and bolts about paragraph 4 of 6. But most people never get that far down. So.
Okay. Eshiru, it's always a pleasure talking with you. We are on the cusp of a new year. A number of people have already expressed their fears for what the year may bring. I always kind of thought that a new start presented us with a new opportunity. But I have to say, even though I'm a positive person and you and I have a lot of plans for keeping ourselves active, I have a feeling the world is not going to develop in the most positive of ways in 2025.
I don't think so either. I have a, you know, we are living the new norm, okay? Inflated prices, more pressure on wages, less affordable homes being built, more and more people going through poverty. Things are going to continue in this way for some time. The only way the changes happen within any society today, people have to take real drastic changes. And when I talk about drastic changes, it doesn't have to be violent and bloody, because most people are not violent people. But simply by deciding not to go out and spend any money today, tomorrow, next day, the day after that, and so on, not go to work, stay in, grind the economy that you're living in to a halt, is the only way you're going to get the people in power to listen. The ballot box doesn't work in most countries anymore. And we're persuaded into thinking that it does. They're constantly pitting us against each other, black against white, against Jews, against Muslims, against transsexual, homosexual. We're all people. We're no different from the next. The one thing that we all want in this life, the one thing, is happiness. That's all the only thing we strive after. We can decide to do it together, or we can allow these people to continue dividing us, and we get nowhere. We have a choice.
Yep, exactly. And our efforts are towards unity, bringing people together. We don't believe in uniformity. I believe, as in, you know, from what our discussions have been like, we don't want to make everybody think the same way, dress the same way, behave the same way, listen to the same music, watch the same movies. No, but to respect the diversity of one another. That's basically what we want to create, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. When we look at this world that we're living today, the world was built by a series of collective efforts from people in different regions at different periods throughout time, okay? Everywhere from the Far East to the Middle East to Africa to Europe. The diversity is what built this world, and it's the diversity that keeps the world moving forward. Difference of opinion, difference of thoughts and ideas. And this is, you know, this is something, it's a legacy that we have to keep moving forward.
Yeah, I'm with you. And hopefully at least there will be some of these positively fused exercises and programs and projects going forward. We will try to find out about them. We will try to contribute our own ones. Eshuru, 2024, for a number of reasons, I look back on warmly. One of those is our friendship, our connection. I'm extremely grateful to you for your time and your work. And yeah, thanks a lot, brother.
Likewise, Zach. Likewise, you know, if I have to pick some positives out of 2024, this is definitely one of them. Thank you.
Cool. All right. I look forward to speaking to you in 2025. Take care, brother.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Two and mic.